Welcome back to Metropolis. It is February 14th, 2024, Valentine's Day. Today, Savannah Craig for Hello Goodbye Lines. How are you doing, Savannah?
I'm doing well, Colton. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Excellent. What do you have for us today on Hello Goodbye Lines?
Yes. Well, I would like to chat about the Uyghur diaspora in Montreal, specifically more about interviews I've been conducting lately with people part of this diaspora and protests, a recent protest that has occurred. So a couple Sundays ago, I attended a protest outside the Chinese consulate in downtown Montreal, which commemorated the Golja massacre, which was when Uyghurs in what is now known as Xinjiang, but formerly pre-Chinese occupation was known as East Turkestan. They peacefully protested against their religious freedoms being persecuted and silenced against by China, by the Chinese Communist Party. And this was in Golja, known in Chinese as Yining, in Xinjiang. And this occurred on February 5th, 1997. So decades later, people are still gathering each anniversary and protesting these events. As a result of these protests in Golja, some protesters were arrested. Some were even shot and killed by CCP officers.
What year did this happen?
This happened in 1997.
Okay, thank
February
you.
February 5th. Yeah, so I covered the event. I caught up with some people and some organizers, some participants at the event, and just heard what they had to say about why they were attending these events and speaking out for Uyghur liberation. So we could check out the coverage from that event.
It's in China.
Really? Why?
They see us as a separatist and terrorist. We cannot have this.
You can't have it. What are other things that show Uyghur culture that are punishable in China?
Well, everything which is Uyghur, any sign of Uyghurness is banned. You cannot talk in Uyghur. You cannot say traditional greeting, assalamu alaikum. You cannot say, talk to Uyghur, you cannot, you have to, you're forced to eat pork, a porcine, and you're forced to eat and drink alcohol. So any sign of religiousness or Uyghurness is banned.
China, stop the genocide!
China, stop the genocide!
China, stop the genocide!
China, stop the genocide!
Close the concentration camps!
Close the concentration camps!
Close the concentration camps!
Close the concentration camps!
Stop organ harvesting!
Stop organ harvesting!
Stop organ harvesting!
Stop organ harvesting!
Uyghurs are suffering!
Uyghurs are suffering!
Freedom for Uyghurs!
Freedom for Uyghurs!
Stop the genocide!
Stop the genocide!
Stop the genocide!
Close the concentration camps!
Close the concentration camps! November 2019, the New York Times published the Xinjiang Papers, an expose that unveiled over 400 Chinese documents, providing a detailed look at the crackdown on Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims in East Turkestan.
Freedom for East Turkestan!
Freedom for East Turkestan!
We want freedom!
Freedom for Tibet!
Freedom for Tibet!
China, stop the genocide!
China, stop the genocide!
Close the concentration camps!
Close the concentration camps!
Close the concentration camps!
Close the concentration camps!
Stop organ harvesting!
Stop organ harvesting!
Stop organ harvesting!
It's peaceful protest, but Chinese government send police and the military. Arrest all of them, killed more than 10 protesters.
Uyghurs in the city of Golja in East Turkestan went on street, peacefully protested against the eradication of their cultural practices, religious practices, and their identity. But unlike us here today in Montreal, they were faced with guns and tanks and brutality and violence. So it's very important for us to be here to continue their voices and their strife for freedom and democracy, because they're being forcibly silenced.
That was a protest just last Sunday, huh?
Not this Sunday, the one before.
The one before.
Yeah.
Thank you. What was the turnout like for that protest?
I would say maybe about 25 people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the smaller side.
On the smaller side, I did see CBC News there, but I believe we were the only two journalists in attendance.
Interesting. Yeah. Have you seen CBC News at the Pali protests lately?
I've noticed it's a bit hard to tell when they're there. Mm-hmm. In November, I saw a CBC journalist there who wasn't very obviously a journalist. Like, it wasn't obvious that she was a journalist in the sense that she didn't have, like, a large camera, sure, like CBC just written.
Maybe writing something.
Yeah. Yeah. I only knew she was a CBC journalist because, I've met her before. Mm-hmm. I attend those Pali protests often, and I don't see that many large media outlets there. I did notice in the first week after October 7th, there was a heavy media presence, lots of cameras.
Of course.
Trying to be timely,
right? So.
Yeah. Maybe once in a while I'll see, you know, the big cameras there. Mm-hmm. But quite often I don't see a large presence. I will see, you know, coverage, but even with that, I do kind of question the journalists that they had on the ground, because I know Le Journal de Montréal, they once said a protest that had 70,000 people in Montreal had 1,000 people. Mm. And I was at that protest.
I didn't. 70,000. Wow. I mean,
it's a big discrepancy.
Yeah, I don't know how you messed that up. Someone's biggest crowd they've seen is 20 people. So anything more is like, well, this must be 70,000. I want to ask you about this a protest attended by Uyghurs. So for people watching or listening who might not know, you gave this little, introduction for the region, but essentially Uyghurs populate kind of like East Turkestan, otherwise known to a Chinese state as Xinjiang. It's sort of in the western region. The climate is kind of dry for the most part. It sort of sits over like one of the northern silk routes. Do you know what the diaspora population of Uyghurs is in Montreal?
Yeah, and I don't have specific numbers for Montreal.
Just a range,
I don't have an exact range for you, but in Canada, in Canada, there is a population of around 2,500.
2,500.
Yeah, so it's quite low.
I think a lot of those numbers are kind of recent too.
Yeah. There are much larger numbers in Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Turkey, and
naturally.
Then kind of like there's a few thousands in European countries, 10,000 in the U.S., 3,000 in Australia. So Canada's on the smaller side. Mm-hmm. But what I did notice from this protest is that like the community seems quite tight knit. I do know I've spoken to someone who's attended one of these protests before, or a few of these protests, and she said it's often the same people kind of attending. And, you know, when I was just observing when I arrived, it seemed that most people kind of knew one another. So very, like, familiar with each other. It seems to be, you know, reoccurring people who attend these protests.
Likely people from the community, I imagine.
Exactly.
I'm Tibetan, for those who don't know. That's sort of the region right just south of East Turkestan. Very similar struggle, I would say, among the diaspora, where it's like, I think especially in Montreal, it's a small community. And when you tell me there's like 25 people present, this to me sounds very similar to a lot of the kind of community-based protests that we're organizing. Yeah, it's been a while since I think they organized one. I haven't been a part of it in a while, but these are similar struggles, right, where it's like you have this diaspora community here who are certain exile far away from their homelands, sort of trying to raise awareness for it. And it's like this small group, and all they're all from the same community, and they're just kind of trying their best to like amplify the issues that they believe are important. I'm kind of curious what you observed at this protest that didn't make it into the video, if anything.
I think I generally like got the gist of what happened in the protests, I guess kind of the highlights. I guess maybe parts that I didn't include in the video that I still do want to publish in some manner is just, you know, people like what community members had to say that I interviewed. And I think also, you know, specific stories of how they're affected by this. Mm-hmm. I think something that maybe I kind of skimmed across in the video, but is a very pressing point, is that a lot of Uyghurs are afraid to speak out because they do have family back home, and they fear that what they say, when they share their truth, they share their experience, and they critique China, they fear that their family members in Xinjiang are going to face repercussions, mm-hmm. for this. And something that is happening that is proven is that more than 1 million Uyghurs in the Xinjiang Autonomous Region are being held in concentration camps. China essentially puts forward that these are re-education camps, and that this is a tactic used to address Muslim extremism in the region. But often what's occurring in these camps, you know, based off of testimonies of people who attended and were able to leave these camps, is that, you know, they're, as someone in this video, this man said, is that, you know, they're forced to eat pork. They don't have freedom to religious practices. They have to learn Cantonese or Mandarin. And I think that that's like a big point that's put forward, is like learning Chinese values. But what's happening in these camps is that it's not just learning Chinese values. It's being forced to erase their own cultural and religious values, mm-hmm. And practices. So that's something that's really strong. And I know that as a journalist, when I attend protests or I enter spaces where there are people who are, you know, fighting for liberation and have their own connection to a struggle, a connection where, you know, maybe there's a lot of mistrust in what they're saying. You know, their family might face repercussions for sharing their truth. I know that there's mistrust towards me because, you know, the media, unfortunately, has a very long history of not, you know, doing certain issues justice and putting kind of incorrect narratives. You know, Palestine is a great example. Sure. But this is also a great example, too, because there's not a lot of coverage. So I think, you know, I'm just there with my camera in my black puffer. And it's like, who is this person? Mm-hmm. You know, obviously I was welcomed, but I definitely, which I'm used to, got the glances of like, who are you and who are you with? Mm-hmm. But I think that's just a normal reaction to the fear of how your story is going to be told, how the movement is going to be portrayed. And, you know, if I will actually give the right narrative and do justice towards this issue when I share it with our audience. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, there's so many angles to this. I think that we could talk about. I guess starting from like the local scene, it's like, it's interesting seeing them kind of, take the time out of their day, their weeks, to make sure that this event is commemorated here in Montreal, that people here in Montreal, despite like the distance to Xinjiang, to East Turkestan, still understand this kind of event that took place. It's like this, I guess, how do I say? It's like this kind of historical event to Uyghurs, which is so important and so impactful and so kind of like difficult to remember, but I guess to sit with, that they're here in Montreal, kind of like sharing it and trying to get people to learn about it. Could you tell what the kind of reaction from passersby were like, if any?
I didn't see a very strong reaction. So essentially the protests gathered outside of the Chinese consulate, which is quite close to here, just on St. Catherine, right behind you, just on St. Catherine. and the protest, I think there were some kind of small speeches. The larger speeches were more at the end, but essentially gathering, they had like an audio plane. You know, people were just holding signs, maybe for 30 minutes. And then we walked a few blocks, as we saw in the video, people were chanting. And then I think maybe we walked 6 blocks and then came back. Kind of like along St. Catherine, up Guy to Maisonneuve and back to the Chinese consulate. Mostly people just kind of like, it was a Sunday afternoon, you know, maybe they were running errands, getting a coffee. They just kind of stopped and looked.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe a couple people took photos, but no real protest against their protest. People were just taking it in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's something that we discussed earlier is that, you know, it's often the same people coming to these protests. And I did want to bring up CBC's coverage, where this was last summer. And this protest was to commemorate the Urumqi riots, which occurred on January 5th, 2009. This is Bakhtiar Samsuddin. I interviewed him a few weeks ago. He's the founder of International Support for Uyghurs. So he organized this protest a couple weeks ago, and he organized this one as well. And I thought that the CBC did decent coverage. I don't think they went into, you know, the deep history of Uyghurs' experiences and, you know, the 1949 occupation of East Turkestan by China. I think they just kind of skimmed it a little bit, which I wasn't surprised because it was more like a news article.
Sure.
But I thought they did, you know, a good job at sharing Bakhtiar's experiences. And, you know, they kind of started off the article saying that, you know, before he came to this event today, he was receiving numerous anonymous phone calls. And what he described is that this is a form of intimidation and harassment for hosting these events. And that this often occurs, you know, before he heads to protests that he's organized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, essentially explained a little bit about what the Urumqi riots were. You know, they were days-long protests that occurred around following false accusations of sexual harassment of a Han Chinese woman by Uyghur men that essentially led to a brawl between Han and Uyghur factory workers. This is in 2009.
And then the protest he organized was in response to that.
The protest that he organized was essentially like a anniversary protest to commemorate. So this happens each July 5th to essentially just bring attention to what happened. Essentially, after these riots in 2009, the Chinese state media reported that these protests escalated to violent attacks targeting Han Chinese people, resulting in almost 200 deaths. And Human Rights Watch documented that after this occurred, that wide-scale police sweeps happened, leading to the disappearances of 43 Uyghurs. Mm-hmm. And Human Rights Watch said that these disappearances are likely much higher. So this protest, they didn't, in the CBC article, they didn't mention the disappearances. I mean, I wasn't at the event. I I can't say whether they discussed it or not, but I know that it is something that comes up among Uyghur communities, is that, you know, especially activists in the diaspora, if they speak out against what's going on in China, they lose contact with their family, and they essentially fear for the worst. Sometimes they may know what happens. They may know that their families have been arrested, you know, end up in these so-called re-education camps. But there are also many cases where they just no longer continue to hear from family members, and they just fear the worst. Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah, it is scary. Yeah. Something kind of interesting I noticed after I published this video with CUTV on Instagram. We had a longer version on YouTube, and I also posted it on my TikTok. A lot of comments on TikTok. A lot of people saying that I've been upholding Western propaganda. So that's kind of interesting, and I know that that is an issue when activists speak out, is that they're being told that this is a hoax.
Specifically on Chinese issues.
Yeah, this is a hoax, and this is a narrative being put forward by the United States to essentially demonize China. I thought we could look at some of the TikTok comments.
Oh, yeah.
If you...
I love these kinds of comments.
...wanted to react.
Not because they're good or I agree with them, but because I like arguing with them.
Funny. This woman is from Chai Allen. Funny, if you visit Xinjiang, you will see many Uyghur script and hear many people speaking Uyghur language. I thought that was kind of interesting because, yeah, Uyghur people live there. So they're, you know, there's going to be evidence that they've been there.
Of course.
For centuries.
I guess his comments, like, what are you talking about? Like, they can still speak their language without being, like, persecuted, but it doesn't really treat the actual attempts by whatever, like, agents to try and, like, get them to speak less or trying to assimilate more into Chinese culture.
What else?
What's the comment with the most likes?
Oh, yeah, let's see that.
Let's see who the leader is in the comments.
This one has 51 likes.
51, not bad.
Truly amazing Western propaganda to smear China after received 1.5 billion. I don't totally understand what that means.
After received 1.5 billion.
There's some comments to that.
Money?
Yeah, not clear. I guess the 51 likers understand it.
Yeah. They're like, so true. How did you get 1.5 billion? So
what else has some high likes?
Yeah, I mean, most of these, I mean, there is like, the thing with these, there is this kind of kernel of truth. Oh, did you find another one?
Yeah, but go ahead. This one leads into something else.
Sure. I do find, like, I think I understand when people, because I mean, like, being Tibetan and like we're like kind of advocating for Tibetan, whether like autonomy or like for like Tibetan kind of causes, I do run into these as well. Like, I think I wrote an article for the Breach a year ago about mining companies that were acting in Tibet, and usually these were Chinese state-owned companies working with Canadian companies like Bombardier, Canadian mining companies. I think there's around 11 or 12 of them, like Canada, China Gold International, Eldorado Gold, a few others. And they're just kind of working like hand in hand to try and like improve China's mining operations in Tibet. And like, just, I did my best to just talk about these processes as like objectively as I could, of course, whatever that means. And then I had people in the comments being like, just a classic Tibetan separatist. You know, it's kind of like what the man in your video was talking about being claimed, being called a separatist, being called a terrorist, which is, I would say, a claim that happens far more to Uyghurs than it does Tibetans. But there's this kind of like idea that like you can't criticize China, because to criticize China would be to back an American narrative, which is not false. I think there's lots of xenophobia. I mean, like last week with our other journalist Neha Chalangi, we talked a lot about the history of xenophobia in Canada and how those policies exist here, you know, and those are absolutely real and those are still like present. And the same applies for the United States, of course. And there's a lot of times you've seen the history of the U.S., the history of the West, attempts to kind of like break into China, to kind of control China. You had that with the British starting the opium wars, getting Chinese people addicted to opium so they could get more silver out of it, get more tea out of it. So it was an uneven trade. And I guess what these commenters, when they're saying you're supporting Western propaganda, is trying to say, like, you know, like, oh, like, you're supporting this line that the West holds. And it's like, it's true, the West holds this line. But, like, that doesn't, like, just because the West holds something does not necessarily make it, like, tainted. Like, I do not trust either, like, American or, I speak now as, like, a Tibetan activist. I don't really trust Canadian or American governments to be, whatever, upholding Tibetan causes or even, I'll extend to Uyghur causes in good faith. Because most of the time it is for their own kind of, like, their own ends, and there's sort of see these causes as sort of like useful victims that they can sort of like appeal to try and like amp up Canadian presence or American presence in China. Now, this isn't to say that these things aren't happening in China, though. You know, these things aren't this just because people like just because you have like Western powers that are sort of trying to use these causes to their advantage does not mean that the causes themselves are not worth supporting, you know? Because, mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, it's this interesting kind of like, I see this a lot, it's this kind of like puritanical thinking, puritanical in the sense of like the Puritans who came here to like the Western United States, who were very much like, everything's got to be like pure Christianity, where like they settled like areas like, what was it like, Providence, Rhode Island, a lot of the East Coast. And they're just purely like, it's all about purity, right? And I find in these kinds of comments where people are talking about you're upholding Western propaganda, there's a similar kind of puritanical morality at play here, where it's like, because this cause has been touched by the hands of American propaganda, because this this cause of like Uyghurs, Tibetans, Hong Kongers, a lot of like kind of like people who are sort of at the whim of Chinese operations, because it's been touched by American and Western interests, it's been upheld by them, it means they should not be supported. And it's pure, like, it's like, because it's like, it has that one kind of like trace of American interest, that we should not kind of support it at all, which is, I think, completely ridiculous and does not speak to any kind of grassroots, like, whatever, like, grassroots kind of a struggle that might be happening. And it completely, like, washes that of its autonomy.
Yeah. Very well said. Very well said.
I've been thinking about this a lot.
I think also I just want to give viewers or listeners as well some kind of background on you know, what's happening in the U.S. Around this issue. There's been multiple senators who have come out and you know, supported Uyghur liberation, such as Republican Senator John Cornyn. He has essentially tried to put forward a resolution declaring China's treatment of the Uyghurs as a genocide. And I quote, he said, this resolution is the first step towards holding China accountable for their monstrous actions. And the Trump administration also decried the situation in Xinjiang and placed sanctions on the Communist Party's top official there. And essentially, the narrative around this is that the U.S. is suspect and making up, you know, what's happening to the Uyghurs in order to demonize China. And I think, yeah, what you say is really great, because I think that we should separate these issues. Even if these politicians are saying factual things, you know, maybe some of them are not doing it with Uyghurs in the forefront of their heart. They're doing it, you know, in order to uphold xenophobic policies and, yes, also demonize China, as China is becoming, you know, more economically strong, and that is seen as a threat by the United States. So, you know, there are tactics that can be taken by certain countries to kind of limit these powers. And essentially what some people are saying, people who believe this is a hoax, they're saying that, you know, these are the one of the tactics to prevent economic growth within China, to encourage xenophobia. especially tied in, you know, with xenophobia that's been happening towards the Chinese community during COVID.
Mm-hmm. And not just Chinese people either, because it's like people, I mean, we had a Tibetan man here who was attacked with a beer bottle, right? And that was supposed to be like anti-Chinese, but like he's not Chinese. Ignorance is blind.
Yeah. And I think that it's just unfortunate that I don't, at least so far, I haven't come across anyone who can separate these two issues. And I think like when I would speak with Uyghur activists, there was some kind of discussion of separation, but obviously they are there to, you know, stand up for Uyghur rights. And a lot of what they said when I asked them, what do they think of this, is, well, you know, I can't get into the minds of people who are saying these things, mm-hmm. but essentially this is happening to me and my family members and my community. So I think I would love to see more kind of separation of, yes, Western politicians can be using this situation to demonize China. But, you know, it doesn't mean that this is not happening. Mm-hmm. I think such an issue, we could actually look at the next article by Al Jazeera. Such an issue is that there's minimal coverage on what's happening to Uyghurs. And I think even, like, I scanned Al Jazeera a few weeks ago. They don't have a ton of coverage, but they do have coverage. This is actually an opinions piece. The faux anti-imperialism of denying anti-Uyghur atrocities. Why are some Western anti-imperialists determined to whitewash China's well-documented crimes against the Uyghurs? And in this article, they state, you know, essentially these atrocities are proven. There are aerial views of the concentration camps. There are survivor testimonies essentially detailing disappearances, torture, and sexual abuse. And there are also leaked state blueprints for mass exploitation and internment. So the proof is there, but, you know, unfortunately, there aren't journalists really being welcomed into these camps. I think there has been a few cases, but essentially what's kind of been put forward is that it seemed very staged. Mm-hmm. They couldn't really access, you know, all parts of these camps and really see, you know, what is the 360 view of what's happening inside of these camps. Mm-hmm. So this is what we have to base off of it, and the fact that more Western outlets are picking up this narrative, and not this narrative, but picking up this story, is causing or kind of fueling this hoax narrative, because it's like people are essentially saying, look, see, Western politicians are putting forth that this is the truth. Western journalists and media outlets are putting forth these stories, but we're not seeing kind of, you know, non-Western outlets, non-Western politicians standing up against this. I mean, go on Al Jazeera. They have great coverage of what's going on in Gaza, mm-hmm. human rights violations in Asia and Africa. And, you know, they published this. They published, I believe it was like a 5 or 10 minute video I watched a few weeks ago, discussing the camps. Really great coverage. So they don't, Al Jazeera isn't denying it. They may not have a ton of coverage, but they are putting forth this narrative.
It's good to see.
Yeah. I think a comment I kind of made a face on earlier.
I want to see this comment.
I want to bring it up. It's a little, essentially the commenter, rather not say is their username, ask these Uyghur if they want to move to Gaza.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead if you
want. That's all right. So if you're a Uyghur, do you want to move to Gaza? My guess is no. But that's just kind of like a cheap, like, whataboutism, I guess. But, I mean, there is something. I mean, it's like, again, I understand what they're pointing at, right? They're trying to be like, look how Palestinians are treated in Gaza compared to how Uyghurs are treated in China. And they're trying to make this kind of comparison of, like, mm-hmm. their, like, conditions where, because Xinjiang isn't being, like, treated like an open air prison. Well, not even like, it's not even that far off from that. But just because like there aren't like active like I guess bombing runs happening, right? That they're like they should be grateful,
mm-hmm.
and there's this sort of like it could be worse attitude to that kind of comment, which is just kind of despicable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think the kernel of truth once again in these terribly rude comments, rude ignorant comments. The person's trying to kind of make this distinction, right? Or not distinction, but I guess this distinction between like Palestine and East Turkestan. And it's interesting because you have what activists are calling a genocide happening in both of them, right? But then the response from the states isn't exactly treating both of them with equal kind of like views. If it is both genocide, right? If like they consider, like if you consider what's happening in East Turkestan a genocide from a governmental perspective, why is it not being treated the same in Israel, right? And I think that just kind of drives the point home where it's like it's not really about the principle of like how a country should stand up against genocide. It's about which country is essentially not the friend of your state. So if like in the case of our states, like Quebec, Canada, the US, their friend is Israel, and even though the genocide is happening there, they're going to support it. But then if a genocide happens in a country that is not as allied, then it's going to be they're going to be against it, right? Mm-hmm. And this kind of point kind of push for the thing I was saying before about like I don't trust these governments to really be there for Tibetans or Uyghurs if they are not there for Palestinians,
mm-hmm.
right? Because
mm-hmm.
it's like it's completely uneven, and if you're not going to be about kind of like just preventing genocide on one level, on one incredibly brutal level that's happening in Palestine, then I don't really trust that that it's in your best interest to stop it in Tibet or in Xinjiang.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 100%. I think something that's been a little upsetting in the last few months is I have had two experiences where I, you know, I was interacting with pro-Palestinian activists, these two activists specifically, very, very unrelated. They don't know each other that I know of.
Get them in a room.
I don't think I want to. essentially, they were very outspoken advocates for Palestinian liberation, and they both said that they believe what's happening in Gaza and Palestine in general is a genocide being committed by Israel. But both denied what's happening to Uyghurs. Both said that this is Western imperialism, Western propaganda, and that I'm upholding this. And both said, show me the proof. And I essentially shared with them, you know, the research that I shared with all of you here today is that, you know, the issue is that there are not journalists welcome into these spaces. But we have leaked documents, we have aerial views, we have testimonies. And essentially both of them said, what am I supposed to believe the testimony of someone I don't know? It's like, you're believing the testimonies of thousands of people in Gaza
that you don't know. No.
So why aren't you believing what's happening to Uyghurs? And I think something that's been very interesting in these last few months during Israel's bombardment of Gaza is that I think a lot of people are, you know, some people still have their eyes closed, but a lot of people are opening up their eyes, and they're not just trying to take in information about what's happening in Gaza, but also trying to take in information about what's happening in Sudan, what's happening in Congo.
Yemen,
of course, all around the world, you know, such horrific human rights violations. But I think what sticks out about Gaza is these images are so horrific, we can't look away. Like the amount of children I have seen with their skulls open, and I've literally seen their brains because they've been bombed. I'll never forget it for the rest of my life.
Of course.
And I think
we're sort of shielded from that here for the most part, right?
We are shielded
from seeing those images, rather.
Absolutely. And I think we're becoming desensitized, and we've already been desensitized. So I think that, you know, images of people being shot, it's horrific, but I think we also live in a society where so many children grow up playing video games. And obviously, you know, there's a difference between like a video game version of you shooting at someone and a real human being being shot at and killed.
Yeah, I think people can feel the difference.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, I've seen images like that from a young age. Like I was always interested in like world conflict. So I think that I kind of grew up looking at these things. I don't think I'm totally desensitized, but you know, the image of skulls being open does hit me a bit harder. And I think that that's kind of the issue here, is that people aren't being shocked by images of what's happening in Xinjiang, what's happening to Uyghurs, is that they don't believe it. They're not being shocked.
It's not the same level of violence.
It's not the same level of violence.
Not the same level of, like, I mean, there's, it's not to say that this isn't like a violent, like colonialism is violent, right? But I guess like what's happening, like, I mean, like Israel's like perpetuating this kind of like really like, oh, like incredibly gutsy, brazen, I would say brazen is the word, kind of like violence upon Palestinian people, where they have these like open, just like bombing campaigns, this kind of completely indiscriminate kind of bombings on purpose, right? And you have citizens being hurt. You have like a lot of people who have access to like cameras being able to like act as witness to this and then broadcast that, right? Where in Xinjiang, you do not have the same kind of like broadcasting power from like a local population. It's always like, I mean, images that come out of Xinjiang and Tibet are always so like trickle. And it's not even to say just those areas either. The rest of China is very kind of like, the airspace in terms of like broadcasting is incredibly controlled, I think, for that reason, to make sure these kinds of images don't leak out. Because even, I mean, when like images do sort of go viral in China of like some kind of like atrocity or some kind of like violence, it's like it always gets a big kind of like reaction. And so they're very, very on top of like the networks or the proliferation of such images.
Absolutely. Yeah, I even, one of those two...
I want to talk to them.
Okay. I think you've talked to both of them.
I have?
I think so. I mean, I won't say their name because they're not here to defend themselves.
You can tell me off the record.
Yeah, I'll tell you later. Whisper.
She said this name.
Actually, this example might make you realize who one of them is. Is that... I had followed this person on Instagram, and I saw that they shared this post, and it was essentially a text that said, "This is genocide," with a photo of, you know, essentially buildings turned into rubble in Gaza City. And then in the same image underneath, it said, "This is not a genocide." And it was an image of buildings in Xinjiang. And that's kind of when I started my dialogue with this person, you know, asking why they think that, trying to, you know, understand the root of their beliefs. And, you know, they wanted sources from me, all these things. And as I said before, you know, I shared the limited kind of journalists on the ground, the limited images, but that there is proof. But yeah, I do find this like comparison to Gaza a bit astonishing. And I think that that's kind of what this comment...
Simplistic.
Yeah. Because would you say that from someone who's escaping violence in Sudan?
No.
It's like at the end of the day, it's all violence.
The comparison of oppressions is the thief of solidarity. Take that, rather not. That's their name, right?
Yeah, rather not say.
Rather not say. I wonder why. Coward. I'm just kidding. Yeah, I mean, this kind of stuff is so... I mean, this is kind of a constant in sort of activist spaces here in Montreal, I would say. And I think this is like a piece I've been working on in my brain for like so long now. But like, why is it that in these kind of activist spaces, among people who would otherwise sort of like be or supposed to be champions of like... the underrepresented or the kind of oppressed, why is it that they kind of take the side of China, or at least not necessarily take the side of China, but at least kind of stop the kind of critique there, right? Critique of like either Chinese state or the party that's in control of it. I think there is something to when you grow, I think not you, But when people grow up here, and there's this sort of idea of the state, the empire, the sort of the good guys of history that people are led to believe that their state or their country is a part of. And then, like, as they learn through educating themselves, through reading about history, through another lens, they're sort of like, oh, wait a minute, like, we did, like, some atrocities too. Like, oh, wait a minute, how is it that there's, like, so many Europeans in Canada? I was like, well, what's this settler colonialism thing? Or like, oh, like, well, there's been so many leaders of the Canadian government who've been sort of, like, either, like, against, like, workers' rights or against, like, or even misogynistic or sort of, like, racist even. And, like, of course, right? And then there's this sort of, like, the way I imagine it, it's sort of like you have this kind of like hierarchy you build in your mind. This hierarchy, there's like two poles to this hierarchy of like good and bad. And it's sort of as you kind of, it's constructed this way that's like, oh, you know, you have these kind of figures of history, of our history, who are sort of at the top, are brave leaders, are bold, like kind of like visionary thinkers. And then like they learn eventually, or eventually sometimes not at all, but they're like, eventually they're like, oh, wait a minute, like, we're not the good guys. We've done a lot of bad stuff. But then there's this kind of void. There's this kind of gap of like, well, then who's the good guy? And if you look through history and you try to imagine the people or forces, organizations, parties, countries who have sort of been historically against the forces of history that have produced your supposed leaders, you kind of instead you're like, oh, they must be the good guys, right? There's just simple, it's a simple inversion, at least that's what I see in it. And then people are like, oh, then there's this sort of like aesthetic and like cultural alignment with like people, like places like Soviet Russia, with China, with like other people who have sort of been against American and like Canadian and like British imperialisms. I think of it as like children of the empire just wanting like some kind of like paternal like imperial figure. And then if they're like, oh, the US is bad, so like enemy of the US, they must be good. You know, and not to say that, yeah, I don't know, that's at least my kind of understanding of why these people exist so readily in these kind of spaces.
No, I think it's a great assessment, but I also think it's so short thought of these people, because it's like China and Russia are empires too,
of course, in their own rights. Yeah, I mean, like, when you think of an empire, it's not just like a singular place, it's like a machine, right? It's a system. And then I think about like ergonomics, you know, ergonomics,
not super well.
Ergonomics is like when something is like sort of like designed to be held or used in a certain way, right? So like the ergonomics of a gun makes it, you're supposed to hold it one way, point one end away from you, and then like use it to to shoot, right? There's like a specific way it's supposed to be used. And that's the way I think about like empires, countries, states, where there's a specific way a state is supposed to be used. As much as who's behind it, as much as people like to think the intention of it is sort of what determines it. It's like what the system is, a system is what it does. And a state is going to be a state. And it, like, even if it's like supposed to be like your good guys behind the state, a state is going to function the way a state does, which is usually repressive, which is usually tries to uphold itself and usually repress others.
Yeah. I just know about ergonomic chairs.
There you go. I mean, like, if you have an ergonomic chair, it's going to be nice to sit in a certain way. And other ways, it's not going to be nice. It doesn't work. It's like just the way the chair is made almost coerces you to sit in it a certain way. You know, there's only one way to sit in an ergonomic chair.
How do you sit in it?
How do I sit in it? Can you bring up a chair? Let's see a chair. Bring up an ergonomic chair.
Can we bring one in next episode?
We can absolutely bring one. I have to bring an ergonomic chair and some tarot cards.
Yeah. Don't forget.
Yeah. I would also want to say to these two like activists, it's like, I think, and even like the people who make these kinds of comparisons to like Palestine and like, oh, it could be worse. And it's not to say that's directly what they're saying. They're not really saying anything directly, which is also an issue in and of itself. It could point to just like a simplified understanding of things, which produces such a simple kind of like inane comment. But it's like, when we talk about like the machines of like empire and like colonialism, they're sort of like countries like draw upon each other and like the ways that they sort of like colonize and brutalize people, because they're like, oh, that sort of like sets the standard of how we should do things. And I should say specifically, this is something I wanted to make sure we talked about, was that in this comparison between Israeli colonialism and Chinese colonialism, there's a good talk a few years ago at McGill, led by my friend Kondo Langri, who's now at Stanford. The talk was called entitled Contemporary Colonialisms, Palestine and Tibet. And it sort of looks at the distinct incredibly distinct ways that both places are being colonized, right? And it's, I say distinct because it's not to say that it's the same sort of forces or the same level of oppression or violence being enacted upon the peoples. But they are both colonialisms because there is this sort of end goal of like expanding one state's territoriality over like a sort of like a non-state entity, whether it's Palestinian people or Tibetans. In China right now, you have this kind of incredibly this turn towards like nationalism and nationalist sort of thinking compared to previous years, which were much more like liberal or sort of like not to say that there isn't any kind of liberalism now, but there's a sort of turn towards kind of like this very kind of classic like nationalism of like sort of like one country and sort of this one nationality sort of being built. And you see that in the re-education camps, right, where they're trying to teach Mandarin, trying to teach Cantonese. I was surprised at that. And in Tibet, you have similar things happening, not necessarily at... I don't know enough about the labor camps in Tibet, but I think that sort of national identity being built, being constructed, is sort of happening at like a school level where you have most like almost entirely the whole teaching being in Mandarin, history, math, everything is sort of in Mandarin. And it's not to say... Well, it's also not to say not. There's going to be a lot of like... There's so much nuance here. But like... The way I see those kinds of like Mandarin instruction courses is sort of like this kind of more national version of China sees almost the pluralism of the country. I mean, it's like a massive country, right? It's like China's a world unto itself. You have like every time I'll read up, like I'm like, what's this random Chinese city? And it's like 13 million people live here, and I'm like, wow, this like they have like multiple Torontos, right? Multiple Montreals. It's like a whole like incredibly huge country. And naturally, in such a huge place, you have so many like different ethnicities. I think technically, in the Chinese register, there's like 55 national minorities. It actually used to be much more. And it's also there's the difficult question of like how do you really like draw a hard line on one nationality versus another for communities and groups that have lived kind of next to each other, sort of like flowing in and out of each other for like decades and centuries. It used to be something in the hundreds. They just were like, oh, no, it's 55 now. And they sort of like amalgamated some of them. Some nationalities, ethnicities were amalgamated into Tibetan as well. And because of that, they were sort of assimilated into like a wider Tibetan culture, which is in itself an issue for these smaller groups. All this to say, when you have a state, when you have this sort of like gigantic entity that wants to kind of be like efficient and sort of smoothly operating, you want one language for it, right? I do see a lot of parallels with like these kinds of the language issues, or at least I see these parallels because I've been informed by these parallels here in Quebec with sort of like language rights for French people, right? Or like maybe in the early history of Quebec, early capitalist history of Quebec, a lot of the companies and corporations and industry here in Montreal was sort of like financed by like people who are like Anglophone in like timber, woodworking, textiles. And there's sort of like this assumption that like this is like an English company, so you're going to speak English, you're going to work in English. And a lot of the trade unionism efforts in the beginning were trying to be like, no, like this is like we're French and it should be our right to be able to speak French and work in French, right? And that was sort of like the efforts there. All this to say, there's this, I think I see a similar kind of angle from the Chinese industrial side of things where they just in the spirit of like efficiency, there should be one language, and they believe that language should be like Mandarin or Cantonese, which is again surprising to me. And then you have re-education camps happening to sort of like try to bring a population that is not in line with this ideal kind of national worker subject, which is like a Mandarin speaking, not too religious person, which is sort of like the already kind of the Han identity. Not to say that there aren't religious Han people; most of China is atheist, but. You have like people like Tibetans who are incredibly Buddhist, Uyghurs, very Muslim, and they sort of don't fit into these kind of productive worker national archetypes that this kind of more national Chinese project wants. You know, they want like this even flow, and it's like it becomes sort of like you have these populations who are unproductive because they don't speak Mandarin, because they aren't like trained in the kind of ways of industry that like Han Chinese people are. And that's where I believe these sites of violence are happening. In the terms of colonialism, where you have this kind of big colonial a system of like a national China, and it wants a certain kind of worker to make things flow smoothly. And then in Tibet and Xinjiang, you do not have those kinds of workers. So they're being put through these re-education camps. So they're being put through this kind of education system in Tibet, which kind of produces like someone that is a Tibetan that is fluent in Chinese, that is a little more kind of like a little further from the character of their like grandparents, which is like not really fluent in Chinese. Some are, and not as instructed in like industrial production labor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's like right now you don't have, at least not in Tibet, you don't have a settler colonial kind of attitude to it like you see in Israel, where you have kind of like every sort of like land grab is immediately propped up by like this kind of real estate and cultural industry. Although they're thinking about it. The recent Minority Ethics Commissioner in China, Dr. Pan Yue, recently became in 2022. His dissertation, his PhD dissertation, was outlining this project that would see 50 million Han Chinese settle into Xinjiang and Tibet. And this was like a sort of like, listen, like, if things take too long, we can follow the example of Israel. He literally names Israel as like a sort of like example to go after. They see Israel's sort of, they specifically, he mentions historical American expansion into indigenous lands into the West, and Russian expansionism when Russia, I think under, actually I'm not going to say who it was under because my Russian history is a little bad, but when Russia essentially expanded outwards into Central Asia and became the kind of like massive landmass it is today. It wasn't always like that, right? That came through colonialism, that came through expansionism. And China, at least this one figure in China, Dr. Pan Yue, who is, I mean, he's one figure, but he does occupy a sort of important government role, is kind of flirting with the idea of drawing upon Russian, American, and as well as Russian and American expansionism and combining it with modern Israeli strategies. Mm. So it's like, even now, if like people try to make the contemporary like comparison to Gaza and they're like, oh, you know, it's not as good, they're looking at ways to make it worse, mm. just to let you know. Anyways, I want to know who these people are.
That's terrifying.
Oh, yeah. 50 million. That's what the project he proposed was.
How did you come across that?
Research.
Yeah. Research. It sounds like deep in it.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I haven't even come across that. And I'm not surprised.
Yeah. I mean, there's still so much more that's just unknown, right? Because, I mean, like I said, China's a world unto its own.
Yeah.
And that means there are, like, officials. And it's not to say that this is, like, it's like all Chinese people are thinking like this.
Of course.
But it's like there's so many kind of like people, like if we imagine this like the Chinese state as like a big machine, there's so many people at the levers, right? So it's like sometimes they're like they want to do things that are counter to what others are doing in the machine, and sometimes they don't. So but it's just concerning that this figure exists at such a high level, mm-hmm. and he has these sort of machinations about a 50 million person settlement of China's western territories.
Wow. Yeah, I'm a bit speechless.
Yeah. I mean, and I will say also, like in similar terms in colonialism, where we think of like the sort of modern the colonizer bringing modernity to like a sort of backwards population, a lot of defense I see of Chinese sort of occupation of Tibet and Xinjiang is very similar to like old like British defenses of British rule in India. They're like people like British rule in India. They say like, you know, we modernized it. We brought like the railway system to it. And like a lot of proponents of like Chinese colonialism, they don't usually even say it's colonialism because they're against colonialism. So they usually can't even identify China as a colonial entity. Oh. A lot of times they'll say similar stuff like, well, literacy rates are up, lifespan is up, and like the railway is there now too, as if that like sort of like excuses what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. I have, I spoke not about what you just said specifically, but I did speak a little bit about the kind of, you know, the comparison with Xinjiang and Gaza and more specifically kind of, you know, like this denial of what's happening to Uyghurs in Xinjiang I mentioned him earlier, Bakhtiar Samsuddin, who is the...
No, he's not there anymore. He's not on the screen anymore.
He is the founder of International Support for Uyghurs, which is a Montreal-based organization. So he has a lot to say. I think we'll just go to the clip and see what he has to say.
Some people who support Palestinian liberation and believe that there is genocide happening in Palestine, sometimes those same people won't believe that there's genocide happening to Uyghurs in East Turkestan. And they will say that U.S. politicians are using this to critique China through false information. What do you think of these types of comments?
Yeah, that's happening. We face that comments also. Some people saying to us, it's not true that genocide, Western countries, United States, using you guys to against China, China's economy, that comments. It's really touching our hearts. It's really, we are really, really sad about that comment. We are trying to explain the issues, genocide, concentration camp, human rights issues, occupations. But if those people, they don't want to understand, they don't want to realize that genocide, we don't have any choice. If that people is really smart people, if they are really on the human rights side, they should understand. We have more than 10 concentration camp survivors. Also, as I told you before, I'm an example, my wife is an example. She has two brothers right now in the jail. One is life sentence, one is 20 years. Her father is here, 80 years old. It's been more than 40 years. He cannot go back to home country. My children also, they always asking me, because our neighbors, we have a lot of Algerian and other group of people. In the summer, they're going back to their home country. We cannot, for me also, since 2001, I didn't go back to my country. Since 2017, I didn't talk to my mother. I very, very, very simple rights. I want to talk. I want to hear her noise, but we cannot. If I call, nobody pick up my phone. We cannot even my uncles, my aunts, sentenced 8 years, 75 years old woman. Those we are a witness. We are explaining those issues that people. Mostly, those peoples are. I'm very sad about that Muslim people, because all of the Muslim countries right now supporting China, Chinese genocide to the Uyghurs. In the United States also, United Nations, they supporting China. Only some Western countries supporting the Uyghurs, because Chinese government. They're trying to cover their guilty. They're building mosques in African poor countries. They're building schools, mosques in some poor Arabic countries. They're helping them. They're giving weapons to the Arabic countries. For example, some of the Arabic countries, they are getting so much support from China. And then they trying to their media educate their people, China is good country, United States is Western countries, bad countries. They are against China using Uyghurs. That's why some people here, some population, they are not realizing the genocide. If they don't believe it, they can go, but they cannot go directly. Even some region of East Turkestan, they are not allowed to go. They can try to go to the Chinese embassy to get visa. Yeah, try it. like everyone here in Canada, they have vacation, they are going to like Cuba, Panama, or the other countries, Europe, to visit. If you don't believe it, spend your little money to visit East Turkestan. Go Urumqi, Gulja. We have like the rich culture. We have 6,000 years old culture in East Turkestan. Uyghurs have it. But what's right now? What's happening? Even they cannot talk any people, like any Uyghur people from my country, if they go there to ask questions also. We have like not too many. We have some news, some reportage. Even if they don't want to believe it, like visit my family. Even give me good news about my family. I want to have a news. If you say like Palestine, they are happening genocide. It's not happening from October. It's issue is happening from the 1947. For us also, our genocide is happening from 1949.
Yeah, so that was Bahtiyar Samsirin kind of speak on a wide variety of issues from his house. I think parts of it that stood out to me, him talking about this disappointment with other Muslim populations who might not be supporting the Uyghur cause, or even, where he might have, I guess there's this difference in like the support you see for Palestinians is almost always kind of in this kind of tenor of pan-Arabism. And that's kind of why I think it's able to get such numbers here in Canada and the world. You never just see the Palestinian flag at these protests. At the beginning, you would see like Moroccan flags, Algerian flags, Lebanese flags. People really, there's kind of strong pan-Arab kind of turnout where Bahtiyar is definitely not seeing that at these Uyghur protests. It doesn't really tap into that kind of pan-Arab identity. Well, mostly because it's obvious, of course, Uyghurs are not pan-Arab, right? They're mm-hmm. Muslim, but mm-hmm. there's no kind of strong pan-Turkic showings either. Interesting thing to reflect on why. And I think it's also important to note whenever we talk about these people, these activists, or otherwise these kind of TikTok commenters, we try to talk about Uyghur or Uyghur struggles, Tibetan struggles, in a sort of like diminishing light. It's a very small group of people. Mm. I think even the people who might be like pro-Palestinian, anti-Uyghur, very small group of people.
Of course.
And I think it's important to remember that. I think sometimes for my own mental health, I need to remember that these are very small, select, very vocal group of people. But I guess it's not even about their size. It's about like sort of the logic of it should be that they should be kind of in the same solidarity, but they're not. And that's sort of the tragedy of it.
I think it can seem so big because there's not a lot of reporting around this. And I think maybe sometimes it could feel like their voices drown out their reporting. But I think it's very accurate what you're saying is that we have to remind ourselves like it's not what everyone thinks. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a good, if people are interested in kind of reading more on the issue, I do recommend this article called Spirit Breaking by Adam Hunervin in Truong Journal. This kind of looks at like sort of the what he calls I think he calls it terror capitalism in China, and how like in the West, the war on terror was a sort of like big show of effort to kind of expand state powers and the securitization, which is to say like surveillance, increased surveillance on its own population, like you have in the US with the NSA, I think it's called the NSA, and in Canada you have CSIS. And sort of the war on terror was this kind of effort to like expand the surveillance powers of these states, as it was in China. I think that article, Spirit Breaking, does a good job of looking at that. And also talks about the kind of mineral resources of Xinjiang, as your video initially did. Mm. Very oil-rich area, which is not by coincidence.
Mm-mm, not at all.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me on.
I don't have a choice. And if I did have a choice, I still would ask you to come
thank
on.
Thank you.
Thank you everyone for watching. This is that's it for today's episode. Hopefully the conversation was enlightening. Hopefully we all learned something. Tune in next week for another episode of Metropolis with returning guest Drew Oyajay. What has Drew got for us? I'm not telling you. You have to tune in next week to find out. My name is Colin Dansebo, and thank you for watching Metropolis. Woo!